And the time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM on your radio dial. Coming up, we got an hour of constitutional law here for you, so do stay tuned. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name's Andrew Geller, and got a solid hour about some very important constitutional law issues that I hope you'd want to be aware of. The first half of the hour, I'll be speaking with Jennifer Van Bergen about the concept of the unitary executive, a phrase many of you may have heard, like me, for the first time during the Senate Judiciary hearings regarding Samuel Alito's potential confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then in the second half of the hour, I'll be speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman regarding impeachment as a general concept and a necessary action in the near future. So, the unitary executive has been written about a whole lot in the course of the past month. And my guest, in the first part here, Jennifer Van Bergen, wrote for findlaw.com on January 9th an article called "The Unitary Executive. Is the doctrine behind the Bush presidency consistent with a democratic state?" Jennifer is a journalist with a law degree. She's author of The Twilight of Democracy, The Bush Plan for America, which came out on Common Courage Press, 2004. And she frequently writes about civil liberties, human rights, and international law. And welcome to the program, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, there has been much said regarding the unitary executive, or sometimes referred to as unitary government or governance. And this is an extraordinarily complex legal issue that I have found many constitutional scholars themselves to sort of not really be all that clear about what it is, if it's actually legal, et cetera, et cetera. So let's just start out with what you understand to be the origin of this concept of the unitary executive.
Well, the origin of it goes back to the founding of the Republic, when there was a discussion in the Constitutional Convention about whether the executive branch should be plural or unitary, whether it should be a body or whether it should be a single person, who in the person of the president. And they decided they wanted it to be a president. They were dividing power, you know, into the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary branches, and so they considered that to be a sufficient division of power, but they felt that there should be a single person who was authorized to act in limited ways. So that's where the doctrine comes from. But the way it is used now by this president is vastly different than what the initial meaning of it was.
Well, let's actually kind of gradually work our way there. We'll definitely spend a chunk of time, but I want to lay more context for at least what the administration says is its rightful claim in terms of its power. Now, as you rightly mentioned, Alexander Hamilton wrote a bunch about the concept of the unitary executive. And that's really where the arguments that the Bush administration and other administrations, this is not strictly limited to the Bush administration, though they are the first to explicitly use this term in their argument. So there's a couple of different concepts here. There's the issue of departmentalism, and then there's a couple of constitutional claims for the basis of this power in the oath and take care clauses of Article 2 regarding the what the president is supposed to do while in office. Can you talk a little bit about the concept of departmentalism and then those two constitutional clauses?
Well, the concept of departmentalism is, my understanding of it is simply that each department, each branch of the government has their own unique authorities. And this kind of gets stretched into, with the unitary executive, that it's also called coordinate construction, which I don't know if it makes much difference what you call it. But the idea that each branch has the authority to, what it comes down to is the authority to determine what the law is. That I'm kind of jumping the gun on that because I had wanted to explain that the unitary executive has three different components.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was actually going to get there afterward, but if you want to do it first, go for it.
Yeah, the first two components of it are relatively uncontroversial. There has been some controversy in the past over specific, issues, but the first one is the authority of the president to appoint or remove officers of the executive branch, and that's relatively uncontroversial. And the second one is the president's authority to administer the executive branch. But the third one is the one that is coming into view and into controversy now, which kind of ties back to, the departmentalism, is whether the president has the authority to decide what is and what is not the law. Now, I do want to say that the president, because he is the executive, he is the one who is mandated to enforce the laws. In order to enforce the laws, he has to be able to decide what the law is to the extent, that he decides whether to bring charges or not and so forth, in the Department of Justice as well as in many other ways. But to say that the president has the final say on what the law is, it really flies in the face of what we've come to call judicial supremacy. Which is that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of what the law is.
Right, and that was something that the Supreme Court affirmed very early on in this republic, Marbury versus Madison in 1803. Everyone probably remembers the name of the legal citation, but may not remember what the case was about. And a few years into the republic, the Supreme Court, in my concept, just reaffirms what the Constitution says in that the judiciary is the one that has the final say on how laws are to be interpreted.
Yeah. And in a sense, it makes a lot of sense because the court is there deciding cases, that the case comes to them and they have to decide what the law is. And if it's the Supreme Court, they're the last place where a case can be decided. They have to be the ones that have the final say. If it's the president that has the final say, then he can simply ignore what either the legislative or the judicial branches say. And in that case, is there really a system of checks and balances?
Well, and that's something that we've seen with increasing frequency in this and, as I reference, prior administrations, but the administrations of George W. Bush have really taken this concept and run with it and are even seeming to try and expand what this this kind of vague definition is to begin with. Do you want to address the oath and take care clause, or is that a little too technical?
Well, you know what I'd like to address? Uh-huh. I'd like to address how what you just said, how the president is doing this. It's a very interesting thing, the signing statements, and the fact that Samuel Alito was really one of the first people to propose using the signing statements to expand presidential power back in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a signing statement by the president is a statement that is issued upon his signing of a law. And previously, the various administrations did use signing statements at different times, all the way back, at least to Madison, I think, or Monroe, to occasionally say, well, you know, I'm signing the law, but, you know, there's things I don't agree with about it. But it's been very rare. I think, if I recall the numbers, it was something like 73 times the signing statements were used between Madison and, somewhere in the mid-80s or 70s.
Right, so almost a couple hundred years.
Yeah, and since then, since I think the Reagan administration up through this president, it was 322 times. And this administration in the first term alone, depending on whose estimate you take, is somewhere between 400 and 500 times that signing statements have been used to make objections to laws. So to go back a little bit, this president has used signing statements to say, I will interpret this law that I'm signing consistent with my authority as the president, and he often will cite his authority as the commander-in-chief,
mm-hmm.
and consistent with the unitary executive, which, of course, you know, unless you know what they mean by that, seems to mean nothing. And the most recent one he also issued consistent with the constitutional limitations on the courts, which is also a very interesting statement, because what does that mean? Does that mean he can simply ignore the courts? He's signing the McCain Amendment, the anti-torture amendment. He signed this, and that's what in part raised this controversy,
mm-hmm.
Because he signed it, but then he basically seemed to give himself a loophole to say, well, I can ignore it if I want to. And that was where he also said consistent with the constitutional limitations on the courts.
And that has to do more specifically with his role as commander-in-chief, because the context in which torture would theoretically be taking place is it's more likely to be in a military context as opposed to a straight civilian, although that couldn't necessarily be ruled out.
Yeah, well, that's another huge issue. First of all, the commander-in-chief powers were given to the president by the founders because they didn't want the commander-in-chief authority to be housed in the military, because they were concerned about military takeovers. So it's kind of interesting, because this president is asserting commander-in-chief authority to basically do whatever he wants, even in a civil context. The supposed war on terror. Now the question of that is whether you can have a war on an idea,
or a tactic.
Yeah, and then the belief in this, the whole thing with the domestic, the NSA warrantless surveillance that he authorized. The question of whether he was authorized by the authorization to use military force, whether that authorizes him as commander-in-chief to spy domestically. So where is the line between these two? When are you talking about torturing in war? Can they torture Hamdi and Padilla? You know, they're American citizens, and Padilla was taken into custody in the United States, and no criminal charges were ever brought against him. And he was detained indefinitely without being allowed to see legal counsel. Can you torture in that situation? And then if that's the case, well, can you go and get Padilla's children and torture them as well? You know, it really raises a lot of very troubling questions.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guest this morning for the first half hour is Jennifer Van Bergen. She's a journalist, has a law degree, and writes frequently about civil liberties, human rights, and international law. We're discussing the unitary executive theory of governance, and she wrote a recent article at findlaw.com. January 9th regarding this issue. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has some more information about this, but not as much as it will have by later on Wednesday. So you can go to kboo.fm, go to the schedule, click People Rise Up, and you'll see a whole bunch of links related to this, as well as the issue of impeachment we'll be tackling in the second half of the show. Now, yesterday, 2 days ago, Monday, January 23rd, George W. Bush defended the National Security Agency spying program, utilizing the concept expressed in the authorization for the use of military force following the September 11th attacks. And he said, quote, "Congress gave me the authority to use necessary force to protect the American people, but it didn't prescribe the tactics." Now, that is a true statement. I will completely agree with him on that, because the wording of that legislation, is extremely broad. And basically it says all necessary. And I'm curious if, just as a slight side, do you feel as though the way some legislation is coming out of Congress, also controlled by the same party the president represents, do you feel as though Congress is letting legislation out that is weakening its own hand?
That's an interesting question. I do think so. And recently, I don't know who it was, one of the senators said something about how the congressional oversight now is just almost non-existent. They've completely weakened their own hands. I think that the authorization to use military force to allow domestic spying by the National Security Agency is such a huge stretch. You know, the Congressional Research Service came out with a detailed paper on this, and then the Department of Justice responded with their own white paper on it. I don't know if this is going to make it to court or not, but I think it's a huge stretch.
Now, one person who has written extensively on the topic of the unitary executive, presidential power, etc., is Christopher Kelly. And he writes, actually, in his dissertation, I guess this is, that there are two forces that manage to solidify the need for unified control by the president. The first was the rise in attention given to the vast administrative state, and the second was that the effect that Watergate had on the governing system. And he contends that it's really the last 30 years where this concept has kind of bloomed, for lack of a better metaphor, although very strong supporters can go back and say, oh, well, George Washington meant unitary executive when he spoke of this other thing. And, you can find concepts similar to this, and that would support it in historical writings. But it's really the last 30 years where it came to be sort of a concentrated, focused effort. And it was Nixon who really seized control of the administrative bureaucracy of the executive. And he writes that there were four specific ways in which he did that, and I won't get into them. People can read his dissertation. But he notes that there was a Office of Legal Counsel opinion from the Department of Justice. Many people are familiar with it in the sense that that's where a lot of these memoranda have been coming from, justifying a lot of Bush administration actions that has its legality questioned. But during the Clinton administration, the Office of Legal Counsel wrote an opinion regarding the significance of the signing statement. Walter Dellinger, then the Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, advised President Clinton's White House counsel that the president was obligated to use a signing statement in which legislation appears constitutional on the surface, but that parts of it would be unconstitutional if executed. And Dellinger continued that a signing statement, quote, that challenges what the president determines to be an unconstitutional encroachment on his power, or that announces the president's unwillingness to enforce such a provision, can be a valid and reasonable exercise of presidential authority. So, again, this is not an exactly brand new thing, but the Bush administration has really taken this concept and run with it.
Well, can I jump in here,
please,
and make a comment? I think the difference, I'm glad you brought the Dillinger paper up. It's a very interesting paper to read. I think the difference is that the presidents like Clinton worked with Congress, and of course Clinton had a Congress which was not his party, and compromised and negotiated and worked through issues. And this president is not doing that. It has a completely complacent Congress. So the balance of power here is shifting dangerously. And as you said earlier, Congress is allowing it to happen. Now we have the danger also that this may happen on the Supreme Court, too.
So what I'm curious about is, with the lack of interest in Congress, as it appears to me, to really address this question amongst the ruling party in Congress, you know, the Republicans are very unlikely to bring the issue up of abuse of power of a Republican occupying the White House. So at this point, and I hate to offer this as the only suggestion, is it really just switching the party in control of the legislative branch? How does one back away?
You mean what's the solution to this?
Yeah, maybe not the solution, but something in that direction.
Yeah, what is a solution? That's a huge question.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different ways this could play out. I mean, if you look at history, you know, many people who are very alarmed will compare what's going on now to what happened in Nazi Germany during the rise of the Nazis. There's also comparisons that could be and have been made to the fall of the Roman Republic and the rise of the Roman Empire. I mean, we think that democracy, you know, American democracy is unimpeachable, as it were, you know, that it cannot be destroyed. But I consider this, what President Bush is doing, it is precipitating a constitutional crisis of a great order of magnitude. I don't think this is something that is, I mean, it would be nice if it could just be resolved by a Supreme Court decision, but I'm not really sure that that would be able to resolve it. He's going down a road which is very, very hard for this country to turn around and back out of. It's creating precedents, and it's creating a lot of, when you don't have a system where there's opportunity for speech or opportunity for appeal or opportunity for oversight. It's like a volcano with a plug in it. There's if you don't allow for healthy expression and dissent and ways of discussing things and working on things, you know, it's going to explode eventually, and that's very worrisome.
You incorporate in your article the unitary executive is the doctrine behind the Bush presidency consistent with a democratic state, something that James Madison wrote in Federalist Paper Number 47, quote, accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny.
Yeah.
Now, it's really kind of a curious situation because Congress has no enforcement authority whatsoever, but they do control the money. The courts get to declare finally and ultimately what law is, but they can't make the executive do anything about it, and they don't really have a way to censure the executive. That's only Congress. But if Congress is controlled by the same party and is unwilling to do anything, it really, you know, it's sort of like things come to a standstill in a sense. Maybe that's not the right metaphor.
Yeah, well, I think that this is, yes, it could very well come to a standstill in a certain respect and stay this way. And, you know, in some respects, the president does need to have authority to act. But what has happened is with over the past, as you mentioned, the past 30 years or so, there's been more and more pressure on presidents to act quickly, and this causes presidents to want to have more authority. This is written about by Harold Coe in his book, The National Security Constitution, which I highly recommend to people to read. I think that, you know, the situation that we're existing in, it can't remain at a standstill forever. Something is going to give at some point.
Okay, so in the last couple of minutes here, any suggestions on how people can help encourage this sort of release of the tension in the system?
Yeah, and in fact, I'm glad you asked that question, because I wanted to mention that in my book, The Twilight of Democracy, I did not know about the unitary executive doctrine when I wrote the book, which came out, a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked to write about the Patriot Act, actually, and I ended up writing about a lot more. But in the first half of the book, I write kind of a constitutional primer. In the second half of the book, I talk about what the Bush administration is doing and how it is violating the Constitution, separation of powers, due process, and all of these constitutional concepts. And one of the things that I say in the book is that democracy is about people talking to each other and sharing their opinions and sharing information. Now, this may seem a very weak solution, but it is the fundamentals of democracy, that we keep talking and keep getting educated and keep informing each other and sharing our thoughts about things. So I would tell people, please get informed, get educated, learn about it. I'm so glad you're doing this on your show, because, you know, people think they cannot learn about constitutional law, that it's way above their heads, but it is not. And people need to learn about it so that they can make these decisions, take them to the polls, write to their senators, whatever they decide that they need to do, but keep speaking out.
Well, and remember, when the U.S. Constitution was written, it was written so that, basically uneducated in the sense that we understand it today, farmers primarily could read it and understand it and decide whether or not they would lend their support to it.
That's right. I even quote a farmer in my book who talks about why he decided the Constitution was okay.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why every citizen in this country cannot learn these basic things and understand them and decide what really, really matters. These things are important.
I've been speaking with Jennifer Van Bergen, journalist, possesses a law degree, author of The Twilight of Democracy, and an article, or two actually, about the unitary executive at findlaw.com. And you can find out more about her and writings about the unitary executive theory at the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. Thank you very much for being on the program to talk about this morning, Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having me. Again, it's been a great pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you. And I will be back in just a moment with Elizabeth Holtzman talking about impeachment. And let me see here. Where am I? Okay. So be back in just a minute. This is a little Ani DiFranco here for you.
Poor. So here's a toast to all the folks that live in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. Here's a toast to all the folks living on the Pine Ridge Reservation, under the stone-cold gaze of Mount Rushmore. Here's a toast to all those nurses and doctors who daily provide women with a choice, who stand down with threats the size of Oklahoma City just to listen to a young woman's voice. Here's a toast to all those folks on death row right now, awaiting the executioner's guillotine, who are shackled there with dread and can only escape in their heads to find peace in a form of a dream. Peace in a form of a dream. Peace in the form of a dream. take away our PlayStations, and we are a third world nation. Under the thumb of some blue blood royal son who stole the Oval Office and that phony election. I mean, it don't take a weatherman to look around and see the weather. Jeff said he'd deliver Florida, folks, and boy, did he ever. And we hold these truths to be self-evident. Number one, George W. Bush is not president. Number two, America is not a true democracy. And number three, the media is not fooling me, 'cause I...
And we're not trying to fool anyone here at KBOO. We just want to try and relay as much information that no one else is willing to talk about to you and let you decide. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My name is Andrew Geller for folks joining us in the second half here. We started out talking with Jennifer Van Bergen about the unitary executive theory of governance, and we're now going to take a look at the issue of impeachment, both as an abstract concept and a necessary immediate action regarding the state of the United States government. My guest to talk about this morning is Elizabeth Holtzman. She is an attorney focusing on government relations at all levels and in litigation. She's a graduate of Harvard Law School back in 1965. She's admitted to the New York State Bar, the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and district courts for the Southern and Eastern Districts of New York. She was elected to Congress in 1972 and served several terms. And she was, I suppose, in a way fortunate and maybe not so fortunate to actually sit on the House Judiciary Committee that impeached Richard Nixon, and we are going to talk about impeachment. Welcome to you, and thank you for joining us, Elizabeth.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate that very much.
Yeah. Now, you have the cover story in the January 30th issue, and I don't think that's quite current anymore because of the time lag with magazine cycles, but the January 30 issue of The Nation magazine cover story, The Impeachment of George W. Bush. And I just want to paraphrase a little from a couple paragraphs at the front end as lead into my first question for you. You write that you've been deeply troubled by Bush's breathtaking scorn for international treaty obligations, the United Nations Charter, the Geneva Conventions, greatly disturbed by the torture scandals and violation of U.S. criminal law at the highest levels of the government. And then compounding this, evidence that George W. Bush and his administration deliberately misled the country into an aggressive war in Iraq. But it wasn't until, you write, the NSA domestic spying scandal that, quote, I felt the same sinking feeling in my stomach as I did during Watergate. Why is that?
Well, because, you know, impeachment is not something that you ever undertake lightly, should never be undertaken lightly, because you're overturning the elected will of the people. And in a democracy, that happens only under the most extraordinary and extreme circumstances. And we learned that during the Nixon impeachment. I had to go back and study something I'd never studied at law school, even Harvard Law School, which is what a high crime and misdemeanor is and what the background is of the impeachment section of the Constitution and why it was put there. And it wasn't until the wiretapping scandals became public and that you saw that the President of the United States, and it wasn't anybody else, it wasn't an aide, it was the President of the United States saying, I am above the law, and it doesn't matter what the law says. As Commander-in-Chief, I can do what I want to do. At that point, I saw such a threat to our democratic system that there is no real alternative other than impeachment. Impeachment was a power granted by the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, who thought long and hard about checks and balances, and while they set up a very strong executive, and they had all kinds of checks in terms of congressional power over the purse and so forth and so on, they still understood that a president could, even in that four-year term, so threaten the democracy and so become like a tyrant that they granted the power of impeachment and removal. They knew that people in power could abuse that power. And so the impeachment is there. It's not to be used lightly. It has to be done in a fair and judicious and responsible fashion, as was done during the Nixon impeachment, which has withstood the test of time. It was done in a bipartisan way. But, you know, Vice President Gore said we should have a special prosecutor look at what President Bush did. Well, let's assume President Bush may have committed a crime. He can't be prosecuted as president, or there's a serious question as to whether he can be prosecuted as a president, and that doesn't remove him from office. The danger that he has now created is that he's told the American people, I am above the law. I'm above the wiretapping law. By the way, I'm also above the McCain law, the anti-torture law that was just passed, he said in his signing statement. I don't have to obey that either.
Well, the Geneva Convention.
How do you protect yourself against this? How do you reinstitute a system in which everyone obeys the law in this country?
Now, let's start out by let's kind of do this in kind of a reverse fashion, because the issue of the National Security Agency domestic surveillance scandal is most fresh in people's mind, but it's far from the only impeachable offense that could be brought against the Bush administration.
That's correct.
Now, the administration basically says there's two reasons why it is able, in the NSA instance, to break the law. First, commander-in-chief conducting military activities during a, quote-unquote, time of war. And the second is that, well, actually, let's get to the second afterward, because it's its own long thing.
Right.
So, commander-in-chief, time of war. What are the courts said about a president's power in a time of war?
Well, let's go back to the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a wonderful quote from Justice Jackson, who's one of the most admired judges on the Supreme Court, and he actually was one of the, I think, the chief U.S. prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. And let's go back to the Korean War. There was a strike going on at the steel mills, and President Truman said, look, I need to have steel for the bullets, for the tanks, for the guns, for the armaments, for our weapons. We cannot tolerate the steel strike, and I'm taking over these steel strikes, the steel mills, and they're going to produce steel. I'm commander-in-chief. And the Supreme Court said, uh-uh, you can't seize the steel mills. And Justice Jackson had a wonderful statement, which was, the president is only commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. He is not commander-in-chief of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think presidents have to understand, yes, they are commander-in-chief, but they still don't have total control over our country. We still have the rule of law. It's an important quote, something that's stuck in my mind, but for a president to say that he's got inherent power, the argument could be that he has inherent power when we are immediately under attack or we have to repel an imminent attack and there's no time to get congressional approval or disapproval. But when Congress has spoken, when Congress says this is how we want it done, the president can't override that. That's as though the president came to the Congress and said, I want to go to war with the Congo. And Congress says, no. He says, I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway. I'm commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the president doesn't have all the powers, even if he's commander-in-chief. He doesn't have all the powers. Congress has been involved in funding wars and making all kinds of decisions with respect to wars. So the president's power, even with regard to being commander-in-chief, is not unilateral. And it's particularly not unilateral where there's a law saying this is how you have to conduct it, period. And so that's the difficulty I see with their argument. And their second argument is that, oh, Congress actually did give us the power to do this. And that's through some amazing, what I would call pretzel kind of, he had gotten to a pretzel shape to figure out how to construe this statute.
This one's beautiful.
Yeah, they say basically because Congress authorized the president to use all necessary force in connection with the war in Afghanistan or against Al-Qaeda, that they overrode the wiretapping law, but that's nonsense. And let me go back to some history here about the wiretapping law.
Mm-hmm.
That was enacted against a background of two very important things. One is Richard Nixon himself claiming national security. I'm commander-in-chief. We've heard that one.
Mm-hmm.
As commander-in-chief, I can wiretap whom I want. And he wiretapped 17 newspaper reporters and White House staffers. The House Judiciary Committee looked at that and said, uh-uh, this isn't national security. This is political. And that was one of the grounds for his impeachment. And it had a bipartisan majority of the House Judiciary Committee voting for the president's impeachment for these illegal wiretaps that he claimed were national security, but that was a false claim. So the second thing was that there had been revelations in the mid to late 70s, about huge domestic surveillance that was illegal by the National Security Agency, by the CIA, by the FBI, you name it. And so Congress said, you know, Congress said two things. You know, the country does need national security wiretaps. We know that they could be foreign governments, foreign agents, foreigners who want to do the country harm. And so we have to be able to wiretap to prevent that. But because we've seen this power abused, we're going to set up a special court approval process. In other words, we're not going to trust a president to just say, oh, this is national security, and do it on his or someday her own. No way. And so it's inconceivable to me that Congress, in this Congress or any other Congress, in light of that past history, would ever say a president could do it on his own say-so. And so Congress did not, granting president right to use force abroad, overrule this statute. And there's Thomas Daschle, who was the Senate Majority Leader and negotiating with the White House, said that was the farthest thing from anybody's mind. And, in fact, I believe that the administration knew that it could never get that law changed.
Well, and actually, they had preliminary talks regarding changing the FISA law and were told not to even think about it because it would not happen. And so I just want to elaborate a little more on the second legal argument regarding the authorization for the use of military force
right.
in the war on terror.
There is none. Right.
So
there is none.
They're claiming that all necessary force means anything Bush can think up and the Justice Department can justify. However, they went to Congress to try and get the military force resolution to be used domestically. Congress shot it down.
That's correct. So they actually did try that. There's
right.
no question. You're absolutely right about that. And I cite that in my article.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that the legislative history is clear on the subject that the authorization of use of force against Al-Qaeda did not authorize them to break the FISA law. And the interesting thing is that now Attorney General Gonzalez, who was the author of this, is now saying, well, it's not a speed issue exactly. We don't have a rationale for why they don't want to go to the courts. But now he's saying, well, you know, the whole process, we've got to get our act together. We've got to show the courts that this is really justified. Hello? That's exactly the whole point.
Right.
The whole point of having FISA was it grew out of the experience of overwhelmingly unjustified domestic surveillance and a president who lied to the American people repeatedly, claiming something was national security when it wasn't. The Congress fully well understood. We have legitimate national security needs, and we're going to create a system that's going to allow national security concerns to be followed and at the same time to prevent wholesale violation of Americans' rights and to prevent presidents from abusing the power of their office. And so I have not seen any rationale that would allow the president to say, I am above the law. If for one second he thought that law did not protect the American people, he should have gone to the U.S. Congress. He knows how to try to get a law through, and he could say, we've got to have this law changed. He never did, and he didn't do that because he knew Congress wouldn't change the law. And he also didn't want the American people to know he was snooping on them. And this last argument that we would have to make our case to the judges and we might not be able to, But that's the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no national security reason, they shouldn't be out there wiretapping.
Right. Just because you don't think that the folks in charge would authorize something doesn't mean that you automatically have the ability to just do it.
That's right. And the purpose of this court system was to accommodate national security needs, create a special court, make it an accelerated process, even allow the president on his own say-so for 3 days to go ahead and wiretap without court order.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to come back and show somebody that it's justified.
Right.
And that's all we're asking of the president, just to show that it's justified, not to his flunkies, not to his yes people, but to an independent court. If it's justified, the court's going to definitely say yes. There's no question about that. Out of more than 10,000 requests for wiretaps under this order, I think only 4 have been turned down. I mean, this court is not going to turn down a legitimate wiretap request. The problem, I suggest, is that maybe these wiretap requests weren't legitimate, and that's the danger. It's not as though this is hypothetical. We saw that in Watergate. We saw how a president, using the term national security, which is a serious term, we all want our safety protected. To abase that term by using claiming national security when it was actually plain old politics.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman about impeachment. She is a practicing attorney, and back in her first term of Congress, when she was elected in 1972, she actually sat on the House Judiciary Committee when Richard Nixon was impeached. Now, Alberto Gonzalez, in his role as Attorney General after the New York Times very belatedly broke this story in December of 2005, conceded, and it's been written up everywhere, that the type of wiretapping they're doing, quote, requires a court order. Now, how the Attorney General, who's in charge of defending this program, would actually let slip the fact that, oh yeah, you know, it does require a court order, and then Bush in 2004, earlier when he was speaking in Buffalo, he mentioned that a wiretap requires a court order, talking in specific about FISA courts, and he said, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so, in reference to wiretapping. So,
in reference to fighting terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So now, of course, what President Bush is saying, well, I didn't really mean that. I was really talking about the Patriot Act. But, you know, the fact that he would mislead the American people about his intentions with regard to wiretapping is not a good sign for the claim that these are national security based. And it's not a good sign when a president says, I am not going to subject myself to, despite what the law says, to any scrutiny by independent third parties. That scrutiny was developed out of some very bad experiences in the United States when we saw a president and executive agencies run amok. And that's what impeachment was designed to prevent. When an executive thinks he's got all the power and is answerable to no one and is above the law, there is no other remedy in our system. There is no other remedy. Regrettably, that's the remedy.
Well, let's use that concept of deliberately misleading the American public and others as grounds for an impeachable offense by looking at the issue of the invasion of Iraq. It has been more than sufficiently documented that, in fact, the entire premise, depending on which, it doesn't even matter which one you look at, because the administration, when one didn't look quite as strong, they'd throw another one up. All of them turned out to, in fact, be bold-faced lies. And this has been documented. And so, again, you know, this is another aspect of what could definitely be viewed as a high crime or misdemeanor, I feel.
Well, let's go back to what a definition of a high crime and misdemeanor is, because I think a lot of people aren't familiar with it, and that's a good thing. It shouldn't happen every day in our country that we have to use that term. Under the Constitution, the president can be impeached and removed from office for treason, for bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, high crime and misdemeanor, it's not clear what that term means. We spent a lot of time during the Nixon impeachment process trying to analyze it, trying to understand it. I had to go back to all these old dusty tomes because it comes from ancient English practice. And what a high crime and misdemeanor means, it's not necessarily a criminal act. It could be, but it doesn't have to be. Nixon's wiretapping may not have been a crime, but it was an abuse of power. And that's what a high crime and misdemeanor means. It means something that could or could not be a crime, but that is an enormous abuse of power, so much so that it threatens our basic democracy. If you go to war, as we did in with respect to Iraq, on a basis of false statements, and statements that now look as though they were deliberately false, then that is something that threatens our democratic system. People in a democracy get a say in the critical decisions over their lives and over their country. There is no more critical, no graver decision than the decision about going to war. And so if you're given, if the people of this country and the Congress of this country are given false information, they can't make an intelligent, rational decision about going to war. It may be, after all the facts had come out, the American people would say, yeah, sure, let's, and the Congress would have said, let's still go to war with Iraq. But the failure to give the truth to the Congress and the American people shows contempt for the democratic process, and again, shows an effort to subvert the democratic process, and I think threatens, in the most profound way, our system of government, because you're risking people's lives, you're taking people's lives, American lives as well as foreign lives, and you're diverting huge sums of money to a war cause on a basis of things that may not be true, and in fact turned out not to be true. There's no question that the administration knew well that there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and yet that was one of the basic arguments about why we needed to go into Iraq, and that was payback for 9/11. He was responsible for the attacks on 9/11, therefore he should be removed from power. But that was just wholly made up out of thin air. And then the other main argument was that there was a mushroom cloud, that Saddam had nuclear weapons and those were threatening to the United States. Well, that was completely untrue, totally made up. There might have been the argument about other weapons of mass destruction, biological weapons, or chemical weapons. First of all, Saddam had no means of delivering them to the United States. But in any case, there was so much information that showed that that wasn't the case. It seems quite clear now that the president made up his mind early in his administration to go after Saddam Hussein. And regardless of the facts, it's still not clear to me why he wanted to do that. But certainly the facts he gave to the American people were untrue and don't seem to be the real reason. And there's a confirmation in British sources, as many of your listeners will know. The chief of British intelligence went to the United States in the summer of 2002 and came back and reported to a meeting of high security types, including the prime minister in Britain. And there was a memorandum made of that meeting, an official memorandum, and that memorandum says that the intelligence chief told the Prime Minister of Britain that the Americans had already decided on going to war with Iraq and they were going to fix the intelligence around the policy. In other words, they were going to make up the arguments to go to war.
There's several other aspects of the Iraq war that relate to impeachable offenses. There's the entire issue of torture and the withdrawal, or I guess practical withdrawal, from the Geneva Conventions. There's issues related to the United Nations Charter. Domestically, there's the War Crimes Act of 1996. There's violations of the United Nations Charter. And for folks out there who are a little uncomfortable about the concept of, you know, quoting international legal documents, anything that the United States signs as a treaty has the force in law of the United States Constitution. Article 6, Section 2 says that. So the Geneva Conventions legally has the same weight as the United States Constitution. Bush also withdrew very, very early in his first term from the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Now, you're a lawyer, Elizabeth. The Senate ratifies all treaties. Therefore, can only the Senate withdraw from a treaty?
Well, that's a complicated question, and I don't really want to get into that now.
But the president sure
can. But the point is also the Geneva Conventions spell out a mechanism for withdrawing from them, which was not followed.
Mm.
But equally important is that there's a U.S. law that was passed in 1996 designed to carry out the Geneva Conventions,
mm-hmm.
and it makes it a U.S. crime for a U.S. national, military or civilian, to engage in torture or to murder or to engage in inhuman treatment of any detainee, and it applies to those who give the orders as well as to those who take them. And that means that even the President of the United States could be guilty of violating that law if he ordered or tolerated the inhuman treatment or the torture of detainees. And I point out in my article in The Nation that there's a serious suggestion that he did this because he was given by, again, Alberto Gonzalez, a written memorandum spelling out that U.S. officials could be guilty under this law with respect to the treatment of detainees in Afghanistan. And the president, instead of stopping that, which he was obliged to do under Geneva Conventions and the U.S. War Crimes Act, opted out of the Geneva Conventions to allow these people who were engaged in abuse to continue the abuse. And that itself may be a violation of the War Crimes Act of 1996, which is a U.S. law and is a felony. And so that could amount to an impeachable offense as well as a criminal offense. That needs to be fully investigated, and the president's role needs to be fully examined. But if he did condone or order the torture or inhuman treatment of detainees by American soldiers, or military officials or people or the CIA or any contract agency, then he could be guilty of a U.S. crime.
Now, we've just got a minute left here, and I want to kind of end where we began, which is referencing similarity to Nixon and Watergate. You wrote in your article that you've now got the same sinking feeling in your stomach as you did during Watergate. I read the articles of impeachment that you helped pass back in July of 1974 to impeach or to forward to the full House to impeach Richard Nixon. I underlined many sections of all three articles that are identical to activities currently taking place. Have you looked back at the articles recently?
Well, I did look at them a while ago, but Article 3 wouldn't apply because it was a subpoena. It was President Nixon's refusal to obey the subpoenas of the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment process. But, yes, the abuse of power, which was at the center of the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and he resigned rather than face certain impeachment by the House and certain removal by the Senate. And it wouldn't have been a close vote. It would have been overwhelming with maybe one or two holdouts in both houses. It would have been overwhelming. The fact of the matter is that what was proven during the Nixon impeachment process was a huge abuse of power. A president who believed he was above the law. A president who took the law into his own hands. A president who lied repeatedly about that to the American people and tried to subvert our democracy. And ultimately, it was a very sad and sobering thing to have to do, to vote for his impeachment. It was one of the most unpleasant things I ever had to do in my life. And I hoped dearly that this would never have to be done again, that presidents would get the message from that impeachment process that no one is above the law. But I was wrong.
And with that, I'd like to thank you very much for taking time out of your day to join us to talk about impeachment. I've been speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman. She's a practicing government relations attorney back in New York. She served on the House Judiciary Committee when Richard Nixon was impeached, and you can find out more about her and her writings by going to the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. Thank you very much for taking some time to join us this morning, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
And as I mentioned, the People Rise Up website has some and will have a whole lot more by the end of Wednesday, information connected to both the unitary executive as well as the issue of impeachment. I appreciate you listening to the program. You have any questions, you can send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. People Rise Up website, kboo.fm. I really appreciate you listening to the program. And tell your friends and family that you can listen to this as an archived podcast or MP3 online, clickable through from the People Rise Up website. Next week, part two. It is happening here, fascism in the United States. So stay tuned for that. Coming up next, Democracy Now! After this enticing message.
Forsooth, the KBOO Board of Directors meeting is upon us once again.
Oh yes, it's warm and comforting in its procedural accuracy.
Come hithermost, that I may bestow the details of the KBOO Board of Directors meeting upon your cranberry custard cranium.
Tis no holograph. The KBOO Board of Directors meeting will be hokey pokey Saturday, January 28th at 10 a.m.
Wherefore art this bodacious Board of Directorial Delicacies?
When you query, Saturday, January 28th at 10 a.m., 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, one half block south of Burnside.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're talking about a wartime foreign intelligence program.